Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for joining us today. Well, this time of year, I often find myself reflecting on how fortunate I am to have grown up in a home where Christ was the center of Christmas. There were things I guess I just assumed, which is that everybody lit candles with the Advent candles, and everyone sung carols that had to do with baby Jesus, and maybe sang in the choir at church, which was a highlight for us since I was in elementary school, middle school, and high school. You would sing at different services, and that was just really fun, and never once thought that Christmas was anything but about Christ. How about you?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I did the same thing growing up. I was a pastor's kid, so I kind of had to, but but the thing that stands out for me is that, you know, going to church, of course, but also at home on Christmas Eve, before opening presents, well, when I had to have lutefisk, but other than that, it was when my dad would get the Bible and we'd have to, you know, we'd get to actually sit around and listen to him read the Christmas story and maybe sing a Christmas carol or two. Then came the presents. It was just, this is first. This is what it's about.
Right. Well, it's not that I didn't ever have questions about God or who he was as I grew. And I asked a lot of those, of course, as I grew and matured in my faith. But I often wonder what conclusions about the Bible or God might I draw if I was raised in an atheistic home, or if I struggled with a difficult thing during my teenage years, maybe my parent getting divorced or had some significant health issues. You know, what would happen if you were thoroughly skeptical about the things that had to do with God? Well, you might have some questions. Well, my guest for today, that was kind of his story. Let me tell you a little bit about him and about his book that he's written called The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. Mark Clark is the author. He's also a founding pastor of the Village Church in Vancouver, Canada. Starting in 2010 out of a school gym, it's now a multi-site church. It continues to grow at a rapid pace. Mark describes himself as a skeptic who became a Christian and then a pastor, all while exploring answers to some of the most challenging questions raised against Christianity. His life follows kind of what I described. He was raised in an atheistic home. He struggled through his parents' divorce and some significant health issues as a teenager. And then at the age of 15, Mark's father passed away, and he began a skeptical search for truth through science, philosophy, and history, eventually finding answers in Christianity. Mark, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. What an intriguing book. You know, you begin with a quote from A.W. Tozer, which reads this: "All of the problems of heaven and earth, though they were to confront us together and at once, would be nothing compared to the overwhelming problem of God, that he is, what he's like, and what we as moral beings must do about him." Why did you start with that quote, and how did that start you on your journey?
Yeah, I started with it because I think that in the midst of all of the, you know, the word problem, of course, can be taken in two ways. It can be a troublesome thing, like a negative thing, which is how some people actually take the title, which is interesting, which is okay, because me as an atheist or an agnostic growing up, you know, in that sense, I was probably bent in a negative way toward God. I had no church, no Bible, no Christianity, no prayer. You know, that Christmas, you know, thing that you explained, I had none of that. Christmas was about gifts and Santa and, you know, Christmas pageants and dressing up like a, whatever, you know, one of the animals, you know, in my elementary school. So that's all Christmas was about. It's about family, too, of course. And those are good things. But, of course, good things can keep you from true things, which is partly, you know, what it did for years for me. But and then there's the other side of the problem, which is it's kind of like a math problem. It's not good or bad. It's kind of a neutral question of, can you figure this out? Is this something that can be solved? And that's really what the emphasis of the book and my story is can the question of God be solved? And so, as you said, when I was 15, having none of that church background, I had heard about Jesus at a summer camp. My parents got divorced when I was 8 or 9, and kind of went through a difficult time. I went away to Christian summer camp. My grandfather had sent me there. He'd actually become a Christian at a Billy Graham crusade years earlier. And he was the only other, the only Christian in my family. And so he sent me away to Christian summer camp. I heard about Jesus and it intrigued me, but it didn't, do much to change my life. And then, faced a crisis of my dad dying. And, going through high school, I was the drug kid and the party kid and do whatever you want. And then when I was those questions of God's existence, eternity, where is my dad? Is there a soul? These massive metaphysical questions about the universe started to, origins, meaning, morality, destiny, kind of rise up in me and start to explore them. And then when I was 17 or 18, I was in woodworking class and a guy who had become a Christian, he was actually a drug dealer and a really good buddy of mine. He had this transformation almost overnight, over the course of a few weeks anyway, where he met Jesus and his whole life got rearranged. And he approached me and said, "You need to get your life figured out with Jesus." And I was like, you're right. It was just something at that moment where I started to go, is this scientifically, philosophically, historically legitimate? Is the Bible true? So I started reading it and just exploring Christianity for what it was. Is this the best idea in the marketplace of ideas? And I found that it was, and accepted it and started to change the whole direction of my life.
Isn't that interesting? Because that awful thing that happened to you, having to undergo your father's death at such a young age, it must have spurred something inside of you to begin asking these questions. And then God, of course, put someone in your life who could start to answer some of those questions, or at least get you intrigued enough to want to find the answers for yourself.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. And that's, beautiful thing about God's grace is that he kind of meets you even when you might not even be looking. Mm. And so I kind of became, almost overnight, I became the guy who, one Friday I'm sitting there, smoking weed and getting hammered in my buddy's garage with 30 of my friends. And 2 weeks later, I'm in the same garage defending Christianity to them and having to really show them, hey, look, this actually is rational. And I think for me, I'm a rational, analytical thinker. I want something not only to feel good but to actually be true. I had to try to figure it out. What are the answers to this thing? So I could then defend it. And so my friends would ask all kinds of questions because, of course, they see me overnight go from this guy who prioritizes all these crazy things to now stopping those things, giving my life to Christ, and having to really defend, the rational side of this. Mm-hmm. Why when we can't see him, feel him? There's nothing about God in my experience as a 17-year-old that would make me evidentially say, okay, he exists. Why do you believe in him now, Mark? How did that happen? And so I had to kind of dig deep and go, wait a minute, maybe your experience is of him, but you have to kind of flip it all upside down and realize this, this, and this, and kind of go down the scientific, philosophical, psychological route, historical route, and then say, if all of this is true, why do you believe what you believe? And then have to kind of push back on them. Because I think, one of the things for me growing up is as I was just kind of I just accepted atheism or agnosticism just because I was sitting around and I built a worldview. And what I try to point out to people, it's really important. I talk about this in the early chapters of the book. And when I get to talk to my family about these things or my friends who are skeptics, is that everyone has a faith position. And so even me growing up, I wouldn't have called it a faith position. I would have said I have no faith, and everyone else who's religious has faith. And but what you realize about people very quickly is they make all kinds of statements about the afterlife, or people will say things like, "Well, at least he's not suffering anymore," and they're atheists. And so when I get to go out with people, I kind of push back against that worldview, and I say, "Well, how do you know that? How do you know that this person is not suffering more? You just made a statement about the afterlife. You made a metaphysical statement of which you have no evidence. So you have a faith position that you've constructed over time through just thoughts of your own that this person no longer exists in any kind of consciousness. But you can't actually prove that. So you actually took a leap of faith. So now let's compare your faith position to Christianity and see if the history, the psychology, the science, the philosophy actually lines up and which idea is actually better to take. So that's kind of what I work through in my life. Almost that first step of becoming self-aware, looking in the mirror and going, what do I actually do have a faith position already, even though I think I don't. Is it actually the best thing?
Mm. Well, you organize this book into 10 chapters with amazing questions. They each focus on a specific argument against Christianity, a problem, if you will. I'd love to talk about those problems. We have to take a quick break, but if you're listening in and you're thinking, now this is a book I need to get my hands on, maybe I have some questions about Christianity. Well, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 877-933-2484. If you have a question, Carissa can take that question, or if you'd like to put your name in a drawing for one of Mark's books, well, he has graciously provided a few to give away. So give us a call, 877-933-2484, and we will be right back with Mark Clark and the Problem of God. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender, pleased to be speaking with Pastor Mark Clark today. He's the founding pastor of Village Church in Vancouver, Canada, and he has written a book called The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. Mark, you start off with one that I hear all of the time. I know you must as well, the problem of science. So how do you approach this retort that science negates Christianity?
Yeah, I think I talk about the idea that, you know, there was a generation probably, you know, in the 60s and the 70s where in the academic disciplines and just out on the street, people said, you know, as time progresses, as we become more technologically savvy, scientific and the way that we explore things, whether that's biology or cosmology or whatever it is, we're going to have more reasons to not believe in God. And that was kind of the assumption of most people. The more secular we become, you know, we're going to become more secular when we delve into science and learn things. And what we found is over the last 30, 40 years, the exact opposite has actually happened, is that the deeper science goes, the more evidence for the existence of God actually starts to come to the surface. So whether that's looking, you know, into the microscope and seeing all the, I talk about the evidence from, you know, biology and the idea that in these strands of DNA, there's like information coded into every living organism. And it seems to be information that comes from a mind, like it's organized. It's, you know, what Francis Collins calls the language of God. There's actually a language going on in DNA strands, and that tends not to happen just if you just give matter enough time by itself. It doesn't tend to organize itself into structure like that. And so it starts to speak to, well, there had to be a mind. So much so that, you know, people come up with theories about how DNA actually came about. If you watch the, I don't know if you've seen the Ridley Scott movie Prometheus, but at the beginning of it, it's actually an alien that's starting human life because it needs a mind to create human life. And so there's a whole group of people who actually, instead of positing God and saying, God, you know, put this DNA in, they say aliens did it, which of course then just forces the question of where the aliens came from. But the idea that this encoded information is pointing toward a mind that had to create something. And then as we look into the cosmos and see, you know, how the universe began, and if anything begins to exist, you know, it has to have a cause. And we, you know, for thousands of years, all the philosophers would just say, well, the universe is the uncaused thing that has always existed. And then we found out in the 1920s and 30s that the universe actually had a beginning. And so anything that begins to exist has to have a cause. So the universe began to exist, ergo the universe has to have a cause. And so science itself has started to say it's actually quite rational and reasonable to believe in God according to evidence. And so when I sit with my atheist friends or my agnostic friends, my skeptic friends, I say, let's actually follow where the evidence leads us, not already assume that there is no God, and then try to just go through life like that. Let's together go where the evidence actually causes us to go, as uncomfortable as that might be for you. And so what we found is this idea that science and the church are always at war with each other. I talk about this in the book. It's just a myth. It's actually never been the case that, you know, the church has hated everything that science has done. In fact, the university is a 12th century Christian idea. Christianity has always wanted science and to delve into the scientific inquiry. The whole modern, you know, scientific method is born out of the garden of Christianity. It wasn't born out of Buddhism, because Buddhism, you know, says that everything we see and feel is an illusion. It's Maya. So that wouldn't produce science, you know. And so you go through the worldviews and you see that Christianity actually best sets us up for the scientific endeavor. And historically, that's what it's done. So it's basically just a chapter blowing away the myth that you either have to choose science or Christianity, and says, no, actually, the two meld together very well.
Well, it's a great way to start your book, because that is such a common problem, if you will, that people would bring up. And, you know, another one that seems quite common is your chapter on the problem with the Bible. A skeptic's popular argument about the Bible may be that it's full of errors, that it's mythology, that it's made up of people trying to invent a religion. So how do you answer those accusations or that problem of the Bible?
Yeah, so one of the things is that if you look at the archaeological data, if you look at all the thousands of historical reference points the Bible makes to the Old Testament and the New Testament, you find that scholars just continuously, the deeper they, you know, study these statements, they see that the Bible just affirms these things and never gets them wrong. Or even if they thought they got it wrong, if they, you know, it's Chronicles or something, if it says that this king was ruling or whatever, and then they say, no, he wasn't. And then years later, they often find, oh, yes, actually, we found this other scroll and he was. And so over and over again, the Bible gets vindicated in all of its claims. I tell the story in the book that there were years where people thought that the Gospel of John was not a good historical document, because in one of the chapters, it talks about a certain pool that's in a certain spot and that there's five pillars there. And you know, people would get up for generations and say, this doesn't exist. Ergo, let's all, you know, throw the Gospel of John out. It's not legitimate. And most people, you know, threw the Bible away and moved on and died in their life. And then years later, they kept digging in that area and they actually found this pool with the five pillars. I've actually been there when I was in Israel a few years ago. And I stood there. I almost started to think, like, look at all the people who drop-kicked their Bible, you know, thinking this wasn't real, moved on with their life and died, and then we just dug a little deeper, and the Bible was yet again vindicated, you know. So over and over again, you look at the large swath of information, and there's not a ton of it that scholars even debate would be historical reference points. There's not, you know, out of the thousands of ways they could, they don't find them. And then, of course, there's the I do a section on the supposed contradictions, and I hone in on three or four case studies of contradictions in the Bible that people say, well, this was a contradiction and that was, and I show that they're not contradictions at all. They're just different ways of explaining things. And then there's people who look at the Gospels, even the most secular scholars, and they recognize that the Gospels are the most trusted documents in antiquity. The whole New Testament is. The amount of manuscripts, the amount of time that had passed, a very short amount of time between the events of Jesus and them actually writing it down. And I compare them to what secular thinkers trust in the, you know, in the secular world. They trust all of these documents that were written 1,000 years after the events, to which they only have a handful of manuscripts. And then the New Testament, which was written, you know, 40, 50 years after the events, to which there's 25,000 manuscripts. This is the most trusted document, and most people would look at that and recognize that. And then there's people who say, well, they just made it up. They, you know, they wrote the gospel stories and they were making up Jesus to make him look good or whatever. And I show that all of the, what Tim Keller talks about, the counterproductive content of the gospels is such that most scholars look at it and go, it feels like these guys are just reporting this is what happened, even though it might create a problem for them. Jesus doesn't know things, right? If you're wanting Jesus to be like, the perfect person, the God who knows everything, then don't put in the story where people walk up to him and say, when are you coming back? And he says, I have no idea. Don't put in the story where that he can't heal people. You know, he walked into the village, he couldn't heal them. Don't put in the story where he's asking in the Garden of Gethsemane, take this cup from me, I'm scared. Don't put in the story where he's talking to himself on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's just going to confuse everybody. Cut those parts out. But the gospel stories just put them in and they go, I don't know, our hero didn't want to do it in the end. He was sweating blood. He was freaking out. He was talking to himself. He didn't know stuff. He couldn't heal people. People look at that and go, this isn't mythology. There's a historical thing going on here. And so it's different than all those mythologies. They're, you know, when you're reading the Gospel of Mark and he's citing people's names and he's saying Alexander, the son of Rufus, and so on. He's actually putting those are like footnotes about eyewitnesses who were there. He's saying, go ask these people. They're still alive. Whereas mythologies back then wouldn't bother with names and details. They just like create ideas of what happened, and you know, so most scholars recognize the gospels and say, man, something is different about this and it's historically viable and worth another read. And that's when I just became a Christian, what I would do is I would sit out and just, you know, smoke my cigarettes and read the New Testament, and I would read the Gospel of Matthew, and I just try to do, and it was, I met God in the pages of the Bible. And one of the challenges I would put out to skeptics is actually sit down and read the New Testament yourself. Don't just read about it, and you're going to, you know, you're going to experience something profound in it.
Well, and even if you read that, you realize that those who are writing it or reporting on it, they don't look so good either. Why
yeah,
would, no, if you're going to write a book?
Fine. Yeah, exactly.
I want to make myself look good.
Power and, yeah, they're always like, Jesus, can I sit on your left and your right? And can I do this? And can I do that? And they look dumb. They look mistake-ridden. They look like petty, you know, kids constantly. And these are supposed to be the founders of the church.
It is interesting just to read your experience in delving in and how all of a sudden things did start to make sense to you and how you did start to change your opinion based on what you would call evidence, but it could also be the Holy Spirit working in you.
Yeah, and I think it was, and I think that's the combination of the rational, analytical, I think there's a biography on C.S. Lewis called The Romantic Rationalist, and it's the combination of those two things. It's the romance, it's the beauty of the gospel, it's the reality of the, it's not only true, but it works. And I think that's, I end the book in the last couple chapters talking about that, like the people around you, they want to see that Christianity is not only true, but it works. And that's where the work of the Spirit moves it from, hey, this is true, to actually, here's how it changes not what you do, but what you want to do. Here's how it changes your affections. Here's how it changes what you treasure and take pleasure and delight in life. And that's the witness to the world that's beautiful.
Well, the book is called The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. It's written by Pastor Mark Clark. We do have a few copies to give away. If you'd like to get one in your hands, you can give us a call at 877-933-2484. We'll be right back with Mark Clark on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. You know, maybe you've had some questions about Christianity, about your faith, or just about God, or you've been having a hard time answering those questions that friends or family members have posed to you. Well, then today is a great show for you. We're talking to Pastor Mark Clark and his book, The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. You know, Mark, you devote a whole chapter to the theology of sex, both addressing the skeptic and equipping the believer as a way to use biblical truths to have a conversation with someone who might actually use the problem of sex as an excuse to not believe in God. How do you address that?
Yeah, well, I think one of the major reasons, past all the philosophical, scientific stuff, is that there's a lot of people in our culture. I mean, my whole church is filled with, you know, millennials, and who would really, at the end of the day, when you really push it, would go, okay, you know, my sexual life is probably the reason behind the veil why I don't want to embrace Christianity. Or people who said, you know, the Christian ethic around sexuality, a man and a woman in the context of marriage forever, that scares me off Christianity. Certainly as a high school student, it, you know, it made me pause whether I wanted to become a Christian, because now God's going to reach into my life and actually cause me to not do what I want to do. And being my own God and following my own pleasures in whatever way I want, with whomever I want at whatever time I want, seems to be the best way to do life. That's what we want to do. And so God's now going to stop me and curb my passions and desires and make me do stuff I don't want to do. And so kind of that self-inflicted slavery of letting pleasure actually define every decision we make is a massive challenge for our culture. Because of course, you know, we can have pleasure in any way that we want now as a culture. And so, how does Christianity actually come in and go, look, God is not anti-sex, if you thought he was, and here's why. God isn't against sex. God is the most sex, you know, he loves sexuality. He created human beings. So the chapter unpacks this idea that he created human beings as sexual creatures. He put them in the garden naked. He wanted them to have children. He wanted a husband and wife to enjoy that. And then I go into secular studies that show, like, that a husband and wife in the context of a marriage have the best sex out there, and that actually blow away all these myths that you have to be 22 and single, living in New York City, you know, having a new girl or guy every night to be the happiest sexually. And it's like, no, actually the best sex is being had by people who are married and long-term, because good sex is hard work. And so, you know, I talk about the idea of the biblical version, the Song of Solomon, the explicit erotic nature of sexuality, and that God's intent wasn't that just a husband and wife get together and shut the lights off and, you know, have sex just to have kids and move on with their life. But there's a pleasure in it, and God is glorified in sex, done in the right way. And so all of that, you know, it's like God created this beautiful thing. Don't you want to know the God that created that thing, the beautiful thing called sex, that probably the, you know, the greatest pleasure on the planet for a lot of people? God is the one who created it. So now let's take a step. It's almost like an evangelistic tool. Like, don't you want to know the God that actually created that? Mm. And so understanding sexuality in its proper context as the greatest point for pleasure, I think needs a lot of work in the Christian conversation, because so often what happens is, even in most books, you know, similar to mine, there's rarely a chapter on this because Christians don't really like to talk about it. Pastors don't even necessarily like to talk about it. In church. And I think we need to be able to do it well. We need to do it respectfully. We don't need to do it crassly, but we need to do it realistically and understand this is behind a lot of these questions is this issue hiding behind the reason why people don't want to become Christians.
Well, I love that you wrote about how you did a series in your church where you just started asking these questions and people just started to come in droves because they have questions and yet didn't feel like they had an arena in which they could ask these difficult questions of why they're having trouble with some of these just natural parts of life.
Yeah. Yeah. And every time we do a series on this or on the topics of this book, these 10 questions that are hitting the skeptics, the people show up in droves, neighbors, family, friends who don't usually come to church. And usually one of the biggest weeks is this week on sex, because people know, man, this is like a real issue. I really want to hear what the church has to say about this, because I've heard all these rumors about what it believes about sex, and now I want to actually hear someone talk about a biblical view of it. And usually the place is pretty packed out, and neighbors and family and friends meet Jesus through series like this. A series like this on the skeptics and on marriage, dealing with these relational issues, people want to come and be able to hear the answers the church provide. And I think we went through a season where people thought no one was asking these questions anymore, and that the world had moved on from kind of, hey, you know, hey, let's evil and suffering keeps me from believing in God, or hell keeps me from believing in God. Nobody cares about those questions anymore. Let's move on. And what we found is that's not true at all. Is that when we do series on answering the questions in this book, where we deal with this stuff, people on the street, even in post-Christian Canada and Vancouver, which is a generation or two ahead of, you know, yours probably in regard to secularization, people on the street want to know how the church answers these questions.
Well, and you also ask some classic apologetic questions, like you just mentioned. The problem of hell is one of them. Does the doctrine of hell actually assist us with our concept of justice?
Yeah, I think it does. I remember sitting having a conversation with a family member of mine who doesn't believe in Christianity, and they just kind of laughed at this idea of hell. And they said, come on, Mark, what are you on about here? You can't actually believe in this stuff anymore. And I remember asking them if they believe that, you know, people around the world who deal with, you know, here we sit in the Western world drinking our lattes, sitting around at Starbucks, waxing eloquently in our comfort of our two-car garages and our, you know, 3,500 square foot homes about what is right and wrong in the universe. But why don't you go to a village that where the women and children get raped and killed, villages get burned down, and ask them what they think about the concept of hell. Ask them what makes them uncomfortable about the concept of a God of justice who is going to bring proper and right judgment on all people, including those who do evil, versus what we sit back in the comfort of our life and go, oh, you know, this hell concept. Because most of the world is going to believe the opposite of what a Westerner does, which is, if there is no hell, then I can't worship that God because he's not bringing about justice on the people who just killed and raped my friends and my family members. He just let them get away with it. And so the reality is let's not be so ethnocentric to sit around in our comfort and decide that our worldview on this question is the best. Don't we want a God of justice who's going to measure out, you know, death and judgment based on a perfect mind who's going to actually carry this out, versus don't worry, everyone's just going to sit around in the end, and every rapist and every murderer, you know, is never going to face the justice that they actually deserve. We're all just going to go to heaven when we die and hang out together. And so this person was kind of caught off guard because I took them down a road where we all recognize that we're people of justice. We want people to be brought to justice. If a drunk driver kills a family member, you don't just go, oh, well, that's tough. You know, you want to see justice brought about. Where did that come from? That comes because you're wired in the image of God, and God is going to bring about perfect justice. But the other thing that people have to understand, too, is that hell, I think, in the scriptures, and I talk about this in the chapter, it's not necessarily the same for everybody. Everyone gets measured according to their life, which is all the passages of the Bible that talk about judgment, whether it's Romans 2 or John 5 or Revelation 21, over and over again, it talks about what people have done with their life. And I think that's because there's a measure of judgment that happens in hell or heaven as well. There's a measure of the experience of heaven that actually gets measured out according to someone's whole life. And so there is a judgment, and I don't want people to think that everyone gets judged the same, because that's what I think my family members struggle with. It's like a Hitler gets the same as the regular Joe. And I'm not sure the scriptures actually bear that out. I think there's a perfect judgment because we're talking about a perfect judge. But there will be judgment, and I think holding on to that is very important, and it's clearly part of what Jesus teaches.
Mm. Well, there's so many great questions that you answer in this book, and I'm so grateful that people feel like they can ask questions, because sometimes we are supposed to think that if we have questions, that's showing a lack of faith, and you dispel that myth completely with the questions that you've asked in this book. I think that we have time for one more. The book concludes with Christianity's, of course, most audacious assertion. How should we respond to Jesus's claim that he is God and the only way to salvation? Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people in my world anyway, and as in the world where I talk to, and they think Jesus is a good guy. They think he's a good leader. They think he's a good teacher. they respect him. Kind of, you know, you see the pop music people with Jesus is my homeboy, you know, people like Jesus. But then you start to get into what Jesus actually claimed, and you start to realize that it's quite exclusive. It's quite offensive. I remember listening to Deepak Chopra as a New Age thinker, and he said, you know, Jesus is a good guy. He's a great teacher, you know, but let's not get into all this Christian stuff that he's the only way to God and so on and so forth. The problem is that if you read the teachings of Jesus, he doesn't really give you much choice. He says, I am God. I'm the only way to God and so on and so forth. So you've got to kind of deal with just not the nice kind of Western Jesus where we pick and choose, you know, love your enemy and so on. You also got to take the stuff where he's saying, hey, look, I'm God and I'm here to create an offense, where you have to choose. So it's not, if you read through the Gospels, everyone either loved Jesus or wanted to kill Jesus, throw him off a cliff. No one was like, no one kind of just liked him. And he creates that in us. And I think he's got to create that for all of us, that we need to figure out, what are we going to do? Is he, as C.S. Lewis said, liar, lunatic, or Lord? You got to give your life to him, or actually look at him and say, there's nothing about him that's any good. Mm. And I think as you read the Gospels and you look at history, I think it's that he actually is God, and that we got to give our life to him. That's what I did.
Well, Mark, just so happy that you took the time to write down not only your thoughts, but a lot of great answers for us to really think about as it applies to our faith and what we think about God, the Bible, and many of these other issues. Mark Clark, again, he's the founding pastor of Village Church in Vancouver, Canada, and the book is called The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. Mark, have a blessed Christmas.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Thank you so much. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. I know you want my heart, my bruises and my scars. I'm coming as I am, the only way I can. Thanks so much for joining us for Connecting Faith today. Had a great conversation with Mark Clark and his book, The Problem of God. Intriguing man. A really great book. If you want to get your hands on that, you can give us a call at 877-933-2484. Coming up next, we'll hear a portion of my conversation with Sky Jathani from the Fuel Leadership Conference about organizational leadership, business, and the church.
So a lot of churches are operating like a business. Mm-hmm. What are the pros and cons of that happening?
Yeah, well, I recognize there's a reality that if you are an organizational leader of any kind, you have organizational responsibilities. There are resources that have to be accounted for. There's taxes or non-tax organizations. There's all kinds of structures to it. Someone else wrote a book a while ago called The Trellis and the Vine as a metaphor for the church, which I found to be helpful. So what they said is that the church itself is like a vine. It's this organic, living thing, and there's some mystery into how it all grows and develops. But the vine needs a trellis. It needs a structure to help it along, and that's where the organizational church comes in. It's the buildings and the staff and the budgets and the programs and all that stuff. But the problem occurs when we believe the vine exists to support the trellis, when in fact the trellis exists to support the vine. So if you are in a church leadership role, you have a trellis responsibility. You need to make sure that those resources are managed adequately and organize in a way that helps the vine grow. However, what I think becomes a problem is when we become so focused on the trellis, we forget that our primary calling is to help that vine grow. And that requires a heck of a lot more than just organizational skill. Mm. It requires prayer and mystery and an engagement with the presence of God that you can't read about in a business management book.
So there are tangible things. You have to manage the budget. You have to make sure the building is, you know, the electricity is paid and things like that are taking place. But so is the immeasurable things, are people being transformed? Are marriages being stabilized? Are people being nurtured? Are those the things that are not measurable?
Well, they can be measured, a lot of them. I mean, we could get down into metrics about how many marriages are failing this year versus last year. I mean, so a lot can be measured, and I'm not against that. But the core idea is the most valuable things can't be measured. Mm. You can't measure someone's communion with God. You can't measure a person's value to say, well, hey, this person's involved in so many classes, and they're giving so much money, and they're leading in such and such a ways, therefore they are more valuable than someone else. And that's where we get into trouble. When we want to quantify everything or commodify everything, I think we're violating one of our core Christian beliefs. And we do that with God as well. We want him to operate within certain boundaries and measure the outcomes. And Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 3. In his own ministry, he says he came and planted the seed of the gospel. Apollos came and watered it, but it's God who causes the growth. And his agricultural metaphor there is important because, you know, if you're called to plant seed, you measure how much seed am I planting. That's great. If you're called to water it, how many gallons of water am I putting on it? But at the end of the day, the actual fruitfulness is beyond measure. It's not something we have control over. The agriculture is a mystery still, even though we try to make it into science. And a lot of churches I go to today, we have abandoned an agricultural vision that leaves room for mystery, and instead we've industrialized it to say, we have this assembly line, and if the widgets, the disciples don't come out the way we want them to in the end, it's because we screwed up the system. And there's no room for mystery in that. And I think it strips God out of the system, it strips people of their dignity, and ultimately it destroys leaders because we attach our complete value to the outcomes of our work. And even Paul didn't do that. Jesus didn't do that. But we tend to do that because we have this industrialized view of everything.
Well, it's the way we've been taught to measure success.
Right.
So as ministers are going into churches and they're trying to lead people, they're trying to have some great economics with the church. They're trying to make sure they have X amount of disciples. These mm-hmm. are the ways that it's been measured in the past. So what in a pastoral perspective has to change in order to get back to that mystery?
Yeah, great question. I think at the very heart of the matter is how a pastor views himself or herself. If you believe that you primarily exist to accomplish things for God, then you will be on a treadmill of church ink. Mm. And you will view yourself and your own value based on how effective am I. You'll begin to view other people based on how useful are they to accomplish what you think needs to get done. So what I find is until a church leader recognizes that their value is inherent, that they are a child of God, holy and dearly loved, regardless of their accomplishment, they're not going to be freed from this. One of the things that I think most remarkable is when Jesus is baptized, there's that amazing moment where the Father speaks from heaven and says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." At that moment, Jesus had not preached a sermon. He had not overcome temptation in the wilderness. He had not called a disciple. He had not done a miracle. He had not done anything in public ministry. And yet he's still declared to be God's child in whom he's very pleased. Likewise, we need to get to the place where our sense of value and worth is not from the fact that I'm a pastor and I'm doing things for God or I'm changing the world in my church. It's inherent to my communion with God the Father. When we come to that place of peace and assurance, then we'll be actually equipped to minister to others who need that same message. But as long as we're trying to prove our own value, we're going to try to make everyone else prove their value, and then we get in this really sick, twisted, wrong way of thinking about ministry and ourselves. So it's really a soul issue. It's not just a tactical change that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental change in perspective for our own identity.
Well, it sounds like a lot of the conversations that are taking place there are about tools of how can we build a better church, have a better worship service, mm-hmm. make a better Bible study, we can give a better sermon. Mm-hmm. We're giving people these tools in which to grow, and yet it sounds like it's not about the tools.
No, I mean, by all means, have those conversations. Years ago, I was in a meeting with Dallas Willard, and he had this great, it was a bunch of pastors, and he said, hypothetically, what if a study came out that proved if you use bright pink offering envelopes, offerings go up 20%. What do you do? Do you use the envelopes or do you not use the envelopes? And so we all debated this for a couple minutes, and Dallas listened to us for a while, and then finally we're like, well, what do you do? And he says, well, you use the pink envelope, but you don't trust the pink envelope. You keep your trust in God. And that's like, well, how do you do that? And so I'm in favor of church leaders thinking through, well, what, you know, given our call to make disciples, what are the best ways to be doing that in our environment, in this setting, in this place? Well, fine, have those conversations. The problem is we trust our own wisdom and our own tools way more than we trust God. Hmm. And we also attach our value and significance to the effectiveness of those tools rather than to our communion with God. There's a great story in Numbers chapter 20 of Moses performing a miracle. Water comes out of a rock. They're in the wilderness. People are thrilled because they have water, and you know, he saves the day. And yet God turns around and condemns Moses because he disobeyed his command. God had told him to speak to the rock, not. So it's a complicated story. But what's fascinating is from a human perspective, his ministry was very effective. It was miraculous even. And yet from God's perspective, he was a failure. Mm-hmm. And this was the sin that prevented him from entering the promised land. So if you're merely looking at the effectiveness of your ministry, that is no guarantee that you are in God's will or that he's pleased with what's going on. He can use anyone to do anything. Don't get excited that your ministry is having amazing effectiveness. Big deal. The question is, are you in deep communion with God and seeking him and getting your identity rooted in him? If that's happening, then whatever the outcomes, you can be pleased in it. Mm-hmm. So that's where we get off base. We're too focused on the outcomes, or the fruit rather than the root is another way of putting it. I think we've become so trusting of our tools and our own sense of control that we have driven our dependency upon God out of the equation. That's what I mean by Church Inc. So again, not opposed to those meaningful conversations about tools and methodologies, but I don't think that's where the battle is.
Well, and it seems that if we're talking about, there's so much out there now about millennials not wanting to be mm-hmm. a part of that Church Inc. Yeah. and really wanting to be a part of authentic community. Mm-hmm. Does what you're saying about this driving force of being, going back to your roots of your identification with Christ have to do with millennials
Absolutely.
Maybe not wanting? Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. There was a great study that came out a number of years ago. I think it was from Barna, asking millennials, what's the number one reason why you go to church or would go to church? Surprise, surprise, the number one response was because they want God. Hello?
Great.
Like, that's great. I mean, and the irony is for a generation, we've been told people don't want God. So we need to come up with other reasons to get them into church, right? They need help with their marriage. They need help with their kids. They need help with their job. They need help with whatever. Get them into church through those things, and then they'll find God. And here's a generation saying, no, we actually want God. Hmm. And a lot of churches are going, what do we do? I don't know what to do. And the other thing that they found, the same study, is asking these people, what's the number one thing that's helped you in your connection with God? Number one response, prayer. Hmm. This is not rocket science. Like this is what
Jesus, are basics.
These are basics. And the great thing about prayer is it's really cost effective. Like you don't need to have a $1 million budget to teach people to pray. But I think behind all that is they also want to be engaged in a community or with leaders for whom that is also their number one agenda, mm-hmm. their communion with God through prayer. And in a lot of churches, there is a sense of, I'm kind of throwing my ministry brothers and sisters under the bus here, but there's a sense of leadership is about using people. If you come to my church, I want to use you. I want to plug you into my system. I want to figure out your gifts and help, you know, get you plugged in so you can advance the institution. And millennials are like, uh-uh. I am not here to fulfill your agenda, leader. Biblically speaking, Ephesians 4, leaders exist to equip the people to do the works of ministry. And ministry does not mean church programming. Ministry means acts of service that bring glory to God. So we've got to get this equation right again and realize that we as church leaders have been given by God to these people to help them commune with him so they can do what he's calling them to do. And that's about equipping and empowering and blessing and affirming. And if that's happening in a community, it's going to happen through relationships. No one would argue that we can get rid of parenting and just have a program for children, right? They need mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and adults in their lives who love them, affirm them, bless them, and equip them to grow up to be adults. Ministry is the same way. Discipleship is the same way. We need actual human relationships where people are known and blessed and cared for and challenged and disciplined in order to grow them up into maturity in Christ. But in our churches, we want to say, no, relationship's not that critical. Here, read these books, go to these classes, come listen to my preaching, and you'll grow as a disciple. I mean, that's insane. Hmm. That is not how it happens. That's not how humans develop. It happens in the context of authentic relationship. And that's really hard to mass produce. You can't industrialize that. So as church leaders, if you want to reach millennials, make some friends who are millennials, right? Build relationships. Help them see God more clearly through your own life. Teach them how to commune with him yourself. And if that doesn't make you excited because you can't mass produce it, then maybe we need to rethink our assumptions about ministry. So what boggles my mind is here's a generation saying, we want God and we want authentic relationships. And the church is going, I'm not sure we know how to do that. Maybe the problem is the church and not this generation.
Well, that was a conversation with Sky Jathani. If you want to hear more from Mark Clark or Sky Jathani, go to myfaithradio.com. You can hear a podcast of those programs and many more. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.